Hey everybody, I'm Eric. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober. My sobriety date is December 2nd, 2001. The Midtown Group is my home group. It's great to be here. Thanks, Billy, for asking me to come down. There you are. Sorry. And it's good to be here. It's an honor to do anything, that's asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I would almost never miss my home group except, if I'm asked to do something else, And quite frankly, it's a nice little break to get away from my. I had somebody cover my service, like it's going to be okay, it'll be all right. And it's good to be here with all of you. And it was nice to drive down here, to drive down to see sort of the green rolling hills. I was telling some folks before, I grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania, kind of in the mountains of southwestern Pennsylvania. It's good to see hills, like where I live now in D.C., it's just flat, And I lived in mountains for most of my life, and it's good to be here. And like I said, I'm an alcoholic. Something happens to me when I drink alcohol that doesn't happen to other people, And there are two things really that happen to me. The first is that when I start drinking, something happens to me. It's called the phenomenon of craving in the big book that doesn't happen to other drinkers. So when I have that first drink of alcohol, something seems to awaken in me, and I can't control the amount of alcohol that I take in. And, I probably could have qualified for Alcoholics Anonymous when I was maybe 18 or 19 years old, but I got to AA when I was 32 and really, got beat up a bit before I came here. And, it's interesting because some of my friends, like in the Midtown group, so a lot of folks there got sober kind of young, and although I could have qualified at that time, if you would have asked me when I was 18 or 19 years old, here's what the phenomenon of craving is, and had me read it out of the book, I would have said, no, I don't think so. I think that I have a drink, and then I change my mind, and I decide to drink more, right? It wasn't until later, when I would really say, I'm really not going to drink, and things happen to me, And and that's the physical part about alcoholism, and most of us, when we've been here for a while, and our head clears, we get that part, right? We look back, and we get that part. But the most cunning part about my alcoholism is the part that resides in my brain. I've been sober for a period of time. I had really bad consequences the last time I drank, but somehow, for some reason, I pick up a drink again. And I'm as physically sober when I pick up that drink again as I am right now. I've detoxed from alcohol. I'm physically sober, and something happens. And that, to me, that's the second part of the first step, that my life is unmanageable when I run it, and that I need new management. It leads me into the second step, that when it comes to my alcoholism and my thinking, I'm strangely insane, And although I like to have some success in life and stand in the supermarket like everybody else, we stand in long lines in D.C. when we buy our groceries, right? And look behind me, look in front of me and think, I'm kind of like these people. I have a job. I'm self-supporting. I have to remember that I am not, right? Because I could easily drive home from the supermarket and my car can somehow, some way, autopilot itself to the liquor store. Has happened to me so many times before, and I can start drinking again, and I am not immune from that today. In fact, sometimes I feel the longer I'm sober, the less immunity I have from alcohol. I sense it sometimes, and if I were to tell you that at 9 years sober, I've never had a craving to drink alcohol in my 9 years of sobriety, that'd be a lie. There are sometimes where I'll see a beer commercial and you see that condensation running down the bottle, and I got to tell you, it doesn't look bad to me, But unlike the way I used to be in the past, instead of indulging in those thoughts and keeping them secret to myself, I'll tell somebody, like, hey, I just saw a beer advertisement, the craziest thing happened, I thought about having a drink. And they're like, yep, that is crazy, we've heard your story, and keep coming back because you need it. So I'm glad that I'm here, and I'm glad that I get to share my message with you tonight, because it reminds me of where I came from, and like I said, I grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania. I probably started drinking with consistency when I was about 15 years old. My father I grew up in the ski industry, so my father was Austrian, right? My mom was a Vermonter. They're too old to be hippies. They were kind of like beatnik generation, and they were kind of loose and fun, and they were both kind of the black sheep of their family. And I was raised sort of in this ski environment all the time. I was raised like in a ski school, so I always had like 100 older brothers and sisters that took care of me, and drinking was a part of that culture. People drank beer and wine, and they partied, and they had a good time, and even in my house, not when I was a young child, but when I was like 12 or 13, if I wanted to have like a little glass of beer with dinner, I could, but that didn't really appeal to me, but I remember even being very young, and And I love the taste of beer, that bitter taste. It seems so foreign to me. It seems that everything else we drank is like either sweet or watery. When I tasted that beer, I was like, man, there's something about that that's really something, you know? And I was a beer drinker at the beginning of my drinking, probably for the first 8 to 10 years of my drinking predominantly, you know? And I loved it. You know, and I don't remember my first drink ever, like I said. And I had this Austrian grandmother that would come over in the winter times when my parents were really busy with work, and she didn't speak any English, and she would kind of take care of my sister and I. And she would sometimes also give us like a little glass of wine. I remember one time it was New Year's Eve, and I really wanted to drink and get drunk. My good friend and I, she said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to make you this very traditional Austrian wine for New Year's. What we do is we boil it for an hour first, and then you drink the hot wine. So what she was doing was boiling the alcohol out of the wine, right? And, you know, she was being a good grandmother and knew what was going on, because there's alcoholism in both sides of my family. Not my direct and immediate family, but it's there. So both of my parents had seen it, and family members of theirs had seen it. I know that now looking back, because alcoholism wasn't apparent in my family, but even when I started drinking when I was a teenager, my parents were kind of on my back. You know, like, where'd you go? How much did you drink? Did you drink and drive? What did you do? You know, and I know that now looking back. At the time, I thought that there was an unwritten rule in my house. As long as I did well in school, which I did, and as long as I did well in sports, which I did, they sort of kind of turned a blind eye a little bit. But looking back now, I see they were looking, and they were watching. And like I said, the first time I remember getting drunk, I was at a friend of mine's house. He owned this big trout hatchery just down the street from where I'd grown up. It was a great place to hang out when you're a kid. We'd go fishing and do whatever. And his parents, for some reason, stopped drinking. I don't think they were in AA. I think his father was probably a problem drinker or a heavy drinker. And they had one of those big oak corner liquor cabinets, you know, the ones you put in the corner, and we'd open it up, and that thing was huge. And my parents didn't really drink liquor, so the first time I had a look at those bottles, you know, just those, all those exotic labels and the different shapes and colors of the fluids and everything, I was like, wow, this is something. And I think we did what a lot of kids do. We got out like a shot glass. I think you hear two stories. One is you get a shot glass and they try everything, or the other kids that were kind of had to be really quick about it get a jar and mix everything up, you know, so you have like cream de menthe and gin and bourbon, like all of it. Like, luckily, we just tried a little bit of everything. And I remember everyone had their thing. And I loved old granddad whiskey. I remember that, you know, right away. And we tried vodka. You tried everything. We were probably doing shots of vermouth. You know, you don't know any better when you're a kid. And I drank that old granddad. And I remember it hit my belly, and it seemed to just warm me up from the inside out. You know, and it seemed to hit my head and my toes at the same time. And I just felt like, and I'm not a person who felt like something was terribly wrong for me all along, but I'll tell you what, when that hit my brain and it hit my soul, and I woke up, you know, and I felt like, man, like there is something wrong with me. You know, I didn't know you could even feel this good. And I didn't feel like a different person or somebody else. I just felt like a better, more comfortable version of me, and I felt great. And I think about the other friends I was drinking with last night and the reaction that they had to alcohol, right? Two of them got into a fist fight, and those guys fought forever, and they're probably in prison somewhere now, you know. One just ran around like an idiot, you know, being crazy, and one got sick and threw up, and I remember thinking, like, what a bunch of idiots, you know. Even that first night drinking, I had like a tolerance for alcohol that my friends didn't have. And I've always been a little guy, and I was a really little kid. I mean, we were hitting the sauce that night. I was probably like, you know, I don't know, maybe 100 pounds or something like that. I seemed to be able to drink more. And my reaction to alcohol wasn't that I got like goofy or drunk. I just felt really good and really comfortable. And for many years of my teen years, I was that guy. I was the guy that at the party would drink more than everybody else and drive them all home, right? Or break up the fight or do whatever. And so even the way that my body seemed to metabolize alcohol was a little different than my friends, you know. And I drank really through high school pretty much consequence-free. You know, I didn't have a lot of good consequences. I did crash a couple cars, but I always, like, not total the car. Things would be okay, and I would fly under the radar. And that was really the unfortunate truth about my drinking life, is I flew under the radar a lot of times. Didn't get in trouble, and I was a good liar, unfortunately. You know, that hasn't totally gone away. You know, it's still there. And, you know, and I've overcome a lot of consequences by manipulating, lying, pretending to be remorseful, or even feeling true remorse, temporary true remorse, right? And getting back at it. And I went to school, to college then in New Hampshire, and, you know, the live free or die state, and there's no tax on alcohol up there, and they have these giant state liquor stores at every they had these like smaller highways with traffic circles, and on every traffic circle they had these giant liquor stores like the size of a supermarket. I mean, if that doesn't encourage drinking and driving, I don't know what does. And I fell in love with Hampshire vodka, which was $4.99 for a plastic half gallon, right? And you know, I'd seen the movie Animal House before I went to college, and I based my entire college career on that movie. I was gonna join a fraternity and be just like that. And I literally, you know, I walked down Fraternity Row my first week there, and I saw, at the end of the row was this kind of semi-condemned, dilapidated house with a bunch of like empty kegs out in front of it and some mangy dogs running around, and that was the fraternity I pledged. It was the hard drinking fraternity, and no kidding, within, and I went through rushing and hell week and all that stuff, and I actually loved pledging. They just force you to drink all the time. I thought that was fantastic. You know, I mean, really? That's a terrible thing. You know, they wake me up at 5 a.m. and make me drink. I thought it was awesome, you know, and no problem at all. And needless to say, you know, I went from being a straight A student to slowly sliding, you know, like many of us do. We slowly start to drop our standards, right? I'm always going to be a straight-A student, right? I'm going to go to, I don't know what my aspirations were. I'm always going to be good in sports. You know, I actually went to the University of New Hampshire. I was a ski racer. I was supposed to race for their school. I got injured. And my freshman year, I had an opportunity to get sent to the Andes and work in Chile and train for ski racing. It was a free deal that was kind of arranged through my college that I could teach and coach ski racing and practice so I could get my strength back and come back and join the team when I got back. But, you know, I got to Chile, right, and 19 years old. It was a wild time down there, too. If you follow history at all, there was this guy named Pinochet who was stepping down from power, and it was a wild time in Chile then. And I was a 19-year-old kid from the country, and needless to say, I got a little distracted when I was down there, you know, and I drank every night, and I found something to help me with my drinking. Wouldn't make me get quite so tired quite so quickly, you know, and I kind of fell in love with that, too. And by the time I came back for my freshman year, it was on. I didn't care about ski racing anymore. It was my identity. It was the love of my life. You know, I wasn't going to be a ski racer anymore. I moved into my fraternity house. I drank and had a great time. You know, and quite honestly, I don't regret my college years. I had just a wonderful time. You know, I really just partied a lot and had a good time with my fraternity brothers. And I'm in touch with a lot of those guys today. And again, what makes me different as an alcoholic, these guys, and if you were to look at those guys and me while we were in college, you'd say, wow, those guys are all a bunch of alcoholics, all of them. Not true. My friends that left, once they graduated from college, they either went to graduate programs or they got jobs, and it seems like as their kind of life responsibilities went up, their drinking went down, right? Mine was just this, and then I just stopped life responsibilities. The drinking kept going up. I was like, because this was too exhausting, keeping this going over here. And that's kind of, and what happened is, you know, after college, I just decided to go back to being a ski bum, you know, and I had these good gigs. At this time, I was still a nationally ranked ski racer, and I got these jobs coaching ski racing and training ski instructors. And I moved to Colorado right after college, you know, and suddenly I found myself living year round in ski resorts. Right, people that go to ski resorts are on vacation. When you're on vacation, it's normal to drink a lot, right? It's not normal to drink that way year-round, but as far as I was concerned, it was, you know. And my drinking just kept slowly progressing. You know, we have a progressive illness, and my alcoholism kind of progressed and progressed and progressed. But, you know, at this time also, I fell in love with, excuse me, it's the pig and steak. we had these dumplings at the end, too, that were delicious, but a little much. And, you know, so my alcoholism is progressing, but there's one thing that blocks me from it. You know, I really have fallen in love at this time with mountaineering and climbing mountains and skiing them. You know, we would climb mountains and we'd ski mountains that had never been skied before. I was with a bunch of crazy guys that did this, and I really loved it. And that's an activity you cannot do when you are drunk or on drugs, or you will plummet to your death, you know, without a doubt. And while I was doing those things and getting involved in these kind of adventure sports and these exciting sports, I could stay sober for a period of time, at least during the day while I was, you know, doing the activity. But as soon as we got back at night, it was on. You know, I did a lot of those things with horrific hangovers, you know, just, you know, drink a bottle of scotch and, you know, get 3 hours of sleep and climb a mountain the next day, you know. Of course, I was in my early 20s, too, and you could do things like that at that time. But my drinking is progressing, right? And at this time, I get these jobs where I can go to, I spend my summers in New Zealand. So I live in New Zealand from from May until like October during their winter, and I'm skiing and I'm climbing mountains, but my drinking is just going, right? Progressing and progressing. And what happens to me, and I'm not sure when it happened, I think this was my sort of mid to late 20s, all of a sudden, you know, I was a daily drinker at this time. I would drink all the time. You know, I would drink at night. I would black out several nights a week. But I had this autopilot that I somehow would get myself to bed. I'd wake up in my bed in the morning. You know, I'd wake up, bit of a hangover, drink some water, and go to work, right? But every now and then I'd wake up and I'd feel kind of shaky in the morning. I would not be capable of making it to work, and I would need a couple of drinks to calm my nerves so I could kind of go back to bed. And this happened somewhere in that time, maybe 25, 26, 27. And then once I started drinking in the morning, there was no stopping drinking, right? So I would drink throughout the day, and I'd think, all right, well, today I'm just going to drink until I feel better, and then tomorrow I'll go to work. And tomorrow sometimes didn't come for several days, you know, and that's sort of the progression of my alcoholism. If I fast forward a couple of more years, then suddenly I get through these periods where I become kind of a periodic drunk, where during the time when I have a drink in the morning, instead of just having enough to kind of calm me down throughout the day, I drink myself in and out of consciousness several times over like a 72-hour period until I get so physically sick that I can't drink again. At this time, I find myself starting to go to hospitals to get detoxed, right? I'm starting to have troubles with my stomach and with my esophagus. I'm sometimes vomiting blood, right? And when it happens, I would think, I have to start eating less red meat, you know? I mean, just the delusion was crazy, right? And this all started to happen pretty quickly in kind of the last 5 years of my drinking. And needless to say, to make a short, long story short, I hurt my knee again. I'd blown out my knee several times, and I had to take a couple years off of skiing. And a friend of mine from college, from New Hampshire, had moved to Annapolis, and he had started a mortgage company. And I was a finance major, which I'd never done anything with if I had a piece of paper saying I was a finance major, you know? And he said, why don't you come to Annapolis just for the summer? I'm going to open a new office in D.C. and you can help me do this. This was in, I think, 1999 or so. And I thought, okay, you know, that sounds interesting. I'll do that. And I moved to D.C. and I helped him open that office. And we started. And for the first time ever, a couple things happened. One was that I was no longer living in the mountains and doing those adventurous activities anymore. So as far as I was concerned, I could just drink all the time because I wasn't going to plummet to my death ever, right? And looking back now, I see I could have easily taken out 10 people on the Beltway, you know, with the way that I drank and drove. But you know how we are. Think about no one but ourselves, right? The second thing is, for the first time ever, I started making some money, you know, and I started feeling pretty important, pretty powerful, right? And thinking like, you know, money, and we started this little thing where we would buy houses in D.C. and we'd fix them up and sell them, and we were doing well, and I was starting to feel pretty important, right? I was starting to feel like I was really somebody, like I had arrived, and I drank throughout the day, but my drinking again was getting worse and getting worse and getting worse, and I would find myself often hospitalized again. And in the winters, you know, I'd be back in Pennsylvania where my sister and I owned this little ski business together that we had taken over from our parents. And I look, you know, having done the amends process, looking back, you know, more harm I did to anyone else during my drinking was my younger sister, you know, who literally turned from my younger sister into my older sister, nurse, caretaker, PR person, right? Had to lie when I wasn't around. We had this business where I was kind of the front man. I just speak in front of people a lot. I had to do presentations, and I would just disappear. And, you know, I was the kind of big brother where she would find my car in a ditch with the door open, and I just wouldn't be there. And it would be days before I was found again, you know, somewhere in some, usually where I grew up, there were a lot of roadhouse saloons, you know, sort of in southwestern Pennsylvania, and I'd be, you know, sleeping under a table somewhere, sleeping it off, or in a hotel somewhere, sleeping it off, you know, And looking back now at the time, I was like, hey, what's the big deal? It's a slow week anyway. Just you handle things when I'm away. You know, it'll be fine. I'd get sober again. And I was very resilient at that time. You know, you could send me into a detox, you know, give me a couple Ativan every 3 hours so I don't have a seizure, get me out, and I could, boom, I'm back up and I'm in front of people doing well. And then something happens. You know, I leave that hospital with a resolve never to drink again. Absolutely, this is the last time. A lot of consequences there. I'm not going to do it. Got it. A few days later, I start to feel physically better, right? Start to feel important again for me. Usually when I was feeling sorry for myself, when I felt like I had my tail between my legs, it was easier for me to ask for help and to stay sober during those times. When things started going my way, when I started feeling important, when I was getting praise from people again, that's when it was hard for me to stay sober for some reason. You know, I would kind of feel good. And again, my car would somehow drive it to itself to the liquor store, you know, or the Steelers would be playing on Sunday afternoon, and I thought, oh, I just got to see the boys, maybe have a beer. No beer. I'll have a Coke. It'll be fine. I'll sit at the bar, have a couple of Cokes, and watch the Steelers play, you know, and then it's several hours later, and I'm not just drinking beer anymore either, you know, and it's on, and it happens again. And I'm on the periodic part. And then really in the last 3 years of my drinking, I really wanted to stop. No longer thought that it's sort of the ages between 29 and 32. I was no longer under the delusion that I would ever control or enjoy my drinking. I knew there was no control. But I didn't understand why I would keep returning to drinking. I'd been to a couple AA meetings. I understood it. I understood what you were saying. But I just felt sorry for you. I'm sorry that you have to go to these meetings all the time and sit in, you know, church basements. I'm kind of an important guy, and, you know, I know that your lives are small and you need to go to AA for the rest of your lives, and thank you for saying hello to me, and thank you for reaching out your hand to me, but you obviously don't know how important I am, and I would leave, and then I would drink again, but I never would put those things together, you know, never would put those things together. That's why I was drinking again, because I thought that I was this self-contained unit that didn't need people, right? And although I related to your stories, my circumstances were somehow different. I don't expect you to understand them, but you don't quite understand them, right? And that's why I drank over and over again. And for many years, I was an AA tourist. And I wasn't a person who necessarily sat in the back and judged people. I would come. I thought you were nice folks, and I related to your drinking stories. But I was a little sorry for you. You know, like, geez, this is all you got going for you now, this AA, I'm sorry. You know, that's really too bad. That's really too bad. I'm a pretty important guy. I got important friends in important places, and they like to drink, and I'm going to go with them. And what I would say, what every guy that drinks again, that I've spotted that drinks again, says, well, you don't understand. I don't feel like drinking, right? I'm fine. I'm going to go to this place. People would say, hey, you know, didn't you drink last time you went there? I'd be like, hey, thank you for shaking my hand and talking to me, but didn't you hear what I said? I don't even feel like drinking. In fact, I had all these things happen to me last time I drank. There's no way I'm going to pick up a drink again, ever. I got it. And then I'd be drinking, you know, in no time at all, no defense at all against that first drink. And that's, again, that sort of relates to me, that second part of the first step, that, you know, my life is unmanageable. And when I run it based on what I think I want and what I need, even if I have the best of intentions, right, I somehow return to drinking. You know, and it's the damnedest thing because I don't know how it happened. I'm just, you know, like Bill talked about, just kind of punching my fist in the bar and thinking, how did it happen again? And that's the reality of alcoholism. And that's, you know, with me, when I'm working with a new guy and I hear that, he don't understand and I don't even feel like drinking, no matter at that point what I can try to do to help that person, I know they're probably not done yet. You know, and I'll be there for them, and I hope they have my phone number, but I know they have not yet finished drinking. And at this time, a thing happened to me, and I can tell you I had a bunch of big events in my drinking that would have been good times for me to stop. I'll tell you, one of my favorite stories is at one point when I was living in New Zealand, I blacked out for several days and woke up in Fiji, you know, and it gets better, and I was wearing women's makeup around my eyes, right? And it wasn't a year later till I found out what had happened, you know? And, you know, I mean, that would have been a great day from the podium to tell you that. And that's when I knew I was an alcoholic and I stopped. But, you know, like every good alcoholic, my drinking didn't end with a bang. It ended with a whimper, right? You know, it kind of went down slow and pathetically. So the last drink I had, I'll get to that in a minute. So in 2001, I found the home group that I had today, the Midtown group, and what had happened was I was dry for about 30 days, and at that point in my life, I was really into whitewater kayaking, right? And I had made a trip, against my sponsor's advice, down to kind of Beckley, West Virginia, down in that area, and I was coming back, and I had been sober for about 30 days. I'd just gone to my only rehab, Psychiatric Institute of Washington. It was a real glamorous place, right? And I knew that I would be the only one to stay sober in that institution because I did my homework and none of the other people there did. I mean, I would fill out my sheets and bring them in. And for the first time ever, I felt like I really had, knowledge of what I had because there were medical people that would talk to us and they showed us the bell curve, which I still don't fully understand. And all these things. And I would think, I'm obviously going to stay sober. But you know what happened to me? And this was the first time I really recognized it, because I actually stayed sober for about 30 days, which probably had not happened to me for years. What happened to me is So I got sober, and at first, you know, the first couple days when you get sober, your life does get better. You're like, okay, I know where my car is, right? Don't have to go find it. I don't have to call my credit card company to find the credit card and to look at the bizarre trail of behavior where I had been the night before, right? But something happens to me as I start to get a little edgy after a few days. You know, I'm not drinking, you know, I'm going to the stupid AA meetings, and I just feel angry and irritable, right? And sometimes I get depressed for no reason at all, you know, and I don't like that because I'm a guy that wants to think that he can control his emotions, right? And I get edgy and I get whatever, and I usually would distract myself with some physical activity. I'd start running or working out or something to just drain myself. And I still think those are good things for new people to do. I think new people have got so much damn energy, they should send them to the gym, make them run till they throw up, something, right? You know, it's something. You know, wear them out, right? Because the problem lies here. The more energy this has, the more trouble I have. So, you know, make it tired any way you can. And, you know, I was whitewater kayaking. I was sober about 30 days. I felt good. You know, it had been a real exciting weekend, a lot of adrenaline. I was driving back. I don't know what the highway is. It's 64 down there, whatever the main highway is. Yeah. And I saw this big billboard that said, Southern Exposure, Gentlemen's Club. And I thought, I'm a gentleman. I think I will go in and have a ginger ale at the Gentleman's Club, right? And I went into the Gentleman's Club to have a ginger ale. You know, and the reality is really, now that I'm sober for a while, I look back, I don't really like strip clubs. I didn't even when I was drinking. But that was my alcoholism, saying, hey, why don't you go look at the girls? But really, it was, why don't you go have a drink? You know, that's what you really need. And I walked in there, and let me tell you, I left somewhere between 5 and 8 days later. And that was my last horrific binge. It was not my sobriety day, but my last horrific binge, and it was bad. And during that time, a bunch of bizarre stuff happened that I don't need to talk in detail from the podium, but the one interesting thing that happened, this was the most bizarre story of the whole situation, is that I came to at one point in my hotel room on the ground, and I remember thinking, I just want some strawberries, because I was so dehydrated and I hadn't eaten for several days, and I must have done something in a blackout, because there was a knock on the hotel door, and of course, coming out of a blackout, I didn't know, was it the police or whoever, and I still had the chain on the door, and I opened it and stood back, and a hand just came through with a pint of strawberries. So I still to this day don't know. I remember I took the strawberries and said thank you and closed the door. So needless to say, that was a bizarre 5 to 8 days, and I was driving home. I figure because I have a full almost hour, I can tell that part of the story. I've never had a chance to tell that before. Driving home, and I'm calling my assistant and telling him to get me into a rehab. And it's a Saturday, and I really feel remorseful, and I feel sick, and I'm throwing up blood again. And I'm pretty sure that what I need is a long-term stay in rehab, right? But it's a Saturday, and nobody can take me until Monday, and I know there's no way. Not going to happen. We get these windows of opportunity, right? The window opens. I want to get sober. I want to be sober. But I know in several hours from now, I'm going to be like, whoa, overreaction, right? And I knew that if somebody could pick me up and throw me into a rehab that night, I'd be okay. But if you're going to make me wait until Monday and it's Saturday, it's not going to happen, you know? So out of an act of complete desperation, I called the Intergroup office in Washington, D.C., which we called WAIA. That's Washington Area Intergroup Association. And they directed me to a meeting, right? Which is interesting because, and I thought, well, okay, if I go to AA for 2 days, then I'll go to the rehab on Monday, which is already crazy thinking. So what I'm telling myself is, I think that AA can keep me sober for a couple of days, and then I'll go to rehab. You know, if I thought it could keep me sober for a couple of days, why not keep it going? But I did, you know, and I went to a meeting, and it was a meeting where a lot of the people of my home group attend. It was called Saturday Night Special, and it was in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I went. And a couple guys were there. And I remember I was just pale. I was green. I was looking not very healthy, you know. And someone asked me, you know, where are you coming from? And I told them the story about the strip club and the kayaking and the drinking and the strawberries. And they just laughed. They just exploded in laughter, you know. And I think that's what's great about AA. Because if I had told a psychiatrist or someone who cared me and loved about me about that, you did not get laughter, right? You just get looks like, oh, my God, this is terrible, you know. And then you're going to make me feel bad about myself, and I'm not going to tell you the truth ever again, right? So, and, you know, so these guys laughed, and they took me out to coffee. And, you know, I know now that's the laughter of relating. You know, those guys related. They had been there. And, you know, I was shaken again, and they took me out to coffee. Don't you love that? We take new people that are shaking and give them a stimulant, right? So I was really shaken, you know, and I was back to where I was. And then I became, you know, I was an AA loser again, and I was going to meetings. Now, I was going to meetings. I was new. And the delusion that I had, I would see the steps, right? And I would think, well, first you stop drinking. This was my plan, right? This is, I didn't tell anybody this plan. First you stop drinking, and then when, you know, you get your wits about you, then you start taking the steps, because I don't know what I thought. That's just what my plan was. But, you know, it didn't work for me that way. So I was going to meetings. I was chasing girls at meetings, right? I was reaching for outside things to make me feel better, and I would just go crazy. And I was getting crazy, I was getting tight again, and I would drink. And you know, I didn't go to these full benders, so I'd go off the grid for a while. Nobody would know where I was. I would come. I would drink and go to AA meetings. You know, I'm the guy that smells like hand sanitizer at the meeting, right? I was drinking, and I had Halls, and I had this theory. Like, if you had Big Red and Halls, nobody would know you were drinking. But, you know, at that point, I'm drinking over a 24-hour period. My maintenance drink is like a half gallon of vodka a day. So the vodka's not just coming out of my mouth. You know, it's coming out everywhere. But you know what? No one ever called me out on it. I wasn't disruptive during a meeting. I usually wouldn't get too drunk before a meeting. You know, just enough to take the edge off so you could bear those unbearable AA people, right? And go. And then, you know, go home after. And I would think, today's my day. I'm just going to have a couple drinks before the meeting. And then I'm not going to drink. But I would have had those couple of drinks. And that phenomenon of craving wakes up. And even if I've waited 4 or 5 hours, by the end of the meeting, I just couldn't wait to go. You know, and I would go, and I live in this part of the city where there are a lot of bars, a lot of clubs, and I would go to this one bar every night, and I would drink a fifth of vodka, right? I'd go home, I'd pass out and think, tomorrow's my day. And for 6 months, I went through this, right? I found my group in June, and finally, you know, in December, I was moving back to Pennsylvania, right, for this winter business that I had with my sister at the time, And all that happened this time, you know, is that I got caught by my sister. And my last drink was a flat Milwaukee's Best out of a plastic cup in a strip club where they had cut off the heat and the electricity. So they were using those outdoor, you know, gas burner things, both as light and as heat. I mean, it was a classy joint, you know. And my last drink was a cup of flat Milwaukee's Best in a plastic cup, and my sister caught me. And that was it. And she put me on a conference call with my parents. And, you know, I'm 32 years old on the phone with my parents, right? How humiliating, right? And I made the mistake, unfortunately, drunk enough to just tell them everything. Just tell them everything. And, you know, to this day, I wish that hadn't happened. But, oh, well. It's a little late for that now, and I've made my amends there with them. And because, you know, I thought that because I had left home pretty much when I was 18, and I had hidden my drinking from them the best that I could, that was somehow being a good son, you know? And I never let them be a part of my life. I had no resentments against my parents. I had really sweet parents growing up. They did the best they could with me, and they were loving and kind, and we didn't have a lot materially when I was young, but I was always loved, and I was always taken care of. But I felt like, and this, I'll get into this the ninth step, I felt like because I kept my drinking away from them as much as I could, I kept my behavior hidden from them as much as I could, that I was somehow doing them a favor. But the truth is, you know, that's not really what it was like. And they heard it all. They were abhorred. They had no idea, you know. And they, you know, they, of course, were like, we will do anything. We'll send you anywhere. We'll send you to the best rehabs in the country or the world. And I knew at that point, I said at that point, I'm like, I know where I need to go. And I was living in southwestern Pennsylvania, and I'd been lying about my sobriety date, and I just went to a meeting, and I shared honestly about what was going on with me and what had been happening. And the meetings that I went to in rural Pennsylvania, there were meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. People were getting sober, they were staying sober, and they were helping others to, you know, achieve sobriety. So they were successful AA meetings. There wasn't the structure that I'm used to today. The message that I got was maybe not the message that I like to get today. But, you know, and for many years I said, well, I went to meetings in Pennsylvania and they weren't very good, but I got sober there, you know, in those meetings. And people really helped me there. And I thought that, I remember there was this big guy, his name was Jerry. He was sober a long time. You know, he was an ex-con. He'd been a steel worker for many years. He's one of those guys. He was like 75 years old. But he looked like he was 50. You know, just a really vivacious guy that kind of lived in the woods. And both of his sons were in prison, you know, for alcoholism issues that they had in their life. And this guy just kind of took a he was a good member of AA, and he put me under his wing, and he took care of me. And he was a tough mountain man. You know, he lived up in the mountains, and he would make me read like the Velveteen Rabbit. You know, this big tough guy making me read the Velveteen Rabbit, which I don't know if you've read that ever. That makes anybody cry. You read that book, right? But he was, you know, trying to melt me, and he said, "You gotta tell your sponsor you've been drinking." You know, I said, if you try to keep this thing a secret and you think that you can have like an AA life in Washington, D.C. and an AA life in Pennsylvania and that it's going to work out, you're wrong. You know, and I thought, okay, I'll wait until I have 30 days sober and then I'll get honest about my sobriety date. I mean, has anybody here had fake sobriety date in this room? Anybody at all? Yeah, I sure did, you know, and I thought, but luckily at this point, like I think I made it like 10 days and I was just breaking down, you know, and I called my sponsor. Some of you guys might know him, Arno S., you know, and I said, I've been drinking, and I thought he was going to fire me or bring down the hammer or something. He said, well, I'm glad you told me. And he said, you know, how's that fourth step coming? Because I'd gotten him a sponsor a few weeks before that. And I said, good. And I hadn't worked on it at all. And he said, well, great. Why don't you drive down next Tuesday and we'll do your fifth step? And I was like, phew. So, you know, so I did it, you know, and it was a great thing because my previous sponsor had been telling me forever to do your fourth step, do your fourth step. I said, yeah, I am working on it. I am working on it, which to me meant nothing, actually. I mean, I was thinking about starting it, right? And that's what I meant by working on it. You know, I wasn't doing anything. And luckily he was just like, great, well, we'll do it Tuesday. And I sat down and I did that fourth step. You know, I wrote that fourth step out, and again, at a couple weeks sober, it didn't mean a lot to me, you know. And at this point in my sobriety, I was listening to a lot of speaker tapes, you know, and I would hear these dramatic drinking stories, you know, and these dramatic sobriety stories. And I would think that, I would thought to myself, well, the fifth step is kind of like a confessional for people that have got like something really heavy on their chest, like, you know, they got a couple bodies buried in the backyard, or, you know, they, you know, did something horrible that no one knows about. And that is the case for some people, you know. It was not my case, you know. My case was just a laundry list of petty resentments, childish emotions, you know. And, you know, the big lie that I found out when I did my fifth step with my sponsor was that I am not the person that I want you to think that I am, you know. And I've been living in that lie for so long, to think that I'm like this self-contained unit who's confident and doesn't need people and all this stuff. It's a lie. You look at me funny. I'm like, why do you look at me that way? You know? Or you make a comment. You know? And I hated that about me. I hated that other people's words and looks could affect me that way. But they could, you know? And because I'm riddled by childish emotions, you know? And so that was what I really got out of my fifth step, is that I'm not the person that I want you to think I am. And being honest with my sponsor at that time was the first time I told everyone that. It's a sneaky way of telling you somebody, because I didn't say that directly to him, but I kept reading it, and I was like, oh, there it is again. You know, and since then, I've had a chance to hear many, many fifth steps, and it's almost like a form letter. You know what I mean? We could just fill in the names and do whatever. And I've come to learn, I'm not telling you you're not special, right? But what I'm telling you is that we are all more alike in this room, even those of us that have never met before and will never see each other again, than I am with my family, with the people that are non-alcoholics in my life. I mean, we are all so incredibly similar, and we are so incredibly not complex, right? I've been seeing shrinks forever that said, oh, Eric, you're so complex. I am not complex. I get upset when I don't get what I want. That's it. That's it. That's it. Or I think I'm going to lose something that I have. That's it. And I'm happy when I do get what I want. And that's the level of my complexity. You know what I mean? And I wish I could tell you that has changed today as I've been sober for a period of time, but it hasn't, you know? And, you know, and doing that fifth step started a dialogue with a guy who sponsored me, and sponsored me not in a gentle way in the beginning of my sobriety. And I was the type that needs a chink in their armor. I'm not a person who felt sorry for himself. I did, but I didn't know it. You know, I came out as arrogant, indifferent. In fact, I was talking to him about some of the conversation we had when I was newly sober. I mean, I would scream and curse at him on the telephone and tell him that he didn't know me. And, you know, unlike the old days, there would be no, this is just kind of, cell phones were mainstream now, there would be no dial tone. And I'd be screaming and yelling, and I realized he would have hung up like a long time ago, you know, and I was just ranting and screaming. And he would say things like to me, like, when you want to try our program, you should give me a call. Click. And I would think, that son of a he has no idea. He's supposed to help me, you know, and he was helping me because he was telling me that, like, your nonsense that you think about yourself and your arrogance and your pride is going to make you drink again. And, you know, and we had good conversations during that time, too, and he spent a lot of time with me. You know, in fact, to this day, I'm not even sure if he's my sponsor. He never said yes, right? He just said, come over to my house, and we're going to read, you know, more about alcoholism. And I'm glad that that's the first chapter that we read together, because I understood, you know, the doctor's opinion talks a lot about the physical manifestation of alcoholism, you know, about what happens when I drink. And I don't know of anyone here, but I've seen a lot of doctors before I came to AA, and I understood that part. And I didn't really care what a doctor had to say anyway, because doctors were always pushing on my side and asking me if it hurt, you know, and I'd be always like, mm-hmm, you know how it is, and how much do you drink a day, you know, 4 or 5 beers, well, that's a lot. And you think, geez, I really just cut it by a fourth, and I tell you that. So I wasn't interested in what doctors had to say, you know. But man, I tell you, and more about alcoholism, those stories about, first the jaywalker, they talk about the jaywalker in there, and the story about Jim, and the story about Fred, those stories to me are the most important stories in that book, because they talk about the type of thinking that happens before we pick up a drink again, and it is bizarre thinking, right? And I love the story about Jim, because for many years I would read that story and I would think, yeah, putting whiskey in your milk, I mean, that's crazy, that's alcoholic thinking. But if you read the beginning of his story, the thinking's happening way before then, right? He went to work on a Tuesday, right? Where were you Monday, Jim? You know what I mean? And he says, I had a few words with the boss, but nothing more. Now, I would love to hear the boss's side of the story, wouldn't you? Jim's saying nothing more. And then he basically takes a car off the lot, and I don't know how they sold cars in the 1930s, but I'm pretty sure they didn't just drive him around looking for someone to buy him, right? And he's going to drive to a place where he had been before to have lunch, where they happened to serve alcohol, and maybe he would find someone to buy the car there, right? So that's some alcoholic thinking right there. That's that kind of crazy, cunning thinking, taking him to a bar where he puts the whiskey in his milk. And by the time he's putting the whiskey in the milk, he's already done. Really, by the time that he probably drove off that car lot after yelling at his boss and telling him, I used to own this company. You're lucky you even have a job that you own it now, and picking up that drink. But I think the even more powerful story to me is the story of Fred, who I relate to a lot. Now, Fred is an accountant, right? He goes to Washington. He has a business trip. And, you know, he'd been sober. He had been to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I relate this. He had met Dr. Bob and Bill, and they had told him about what they had. And he related. He related to their drinking. He related to what happened to them. But he said, you know, I really appreciate the information. Now that I'm armed with the facts that you've told me, I won't pick up a drink again because I know what I have. Thank you very much. And they were like, well, actually, Fred, you know, we found that we have to. He's like, thank you very much. Thank you. And he probably did it in a very polite way, because I'm like that too. I can nod, right, politely and thank you. Oh, thank you. I thank you for your advice. And I walk away and think, idiot. He doesn't know my situation, right? And Fred, you know, unfortunately for Fred, like many of us when we're newly sober, good news is bad news, right? His business comes off well. He's feeling like his company's going to be happy. His clients are going to be happy. Everything's come off great. He's walking across the hotel. I can see it, right? He's walking across the lobby. He's probably like, hey, you know, he's like a little gleam on his tooth, right? As he smiles, just like, hey, you know, and he thinks maybe a highball before dinner, you know, would be a good idea. And I relate to that type of thinking. And there's a very, very small voice in the back saying, ah, it's not a good idea. And it's like, poof, gone. That's gone. And he does, and he's at it again, and, you know, it happens. And I relate to that. You know, I relate to, and those are the things that would happen to me over and over again. And I'm glad we get into that. And to this day, you know, having worked with alcoholics and, you know, having stayed sober for a couple of years, I know that that's the part of alcoholism that takes us out. You know, once you get a little bit of time sober and you have detoxed from alcohol, it doesn't matter what I know what's happened to me. It doesn't matter what the consequences were of my last drink. If I am an alcoholic and I don't have a spiritual solution and find a God of my understanding through working the steps with the help of a sponsor, I will absolutely pick up a drink again. It's happened to me in my sobriety many times. And, you know, luckily, you know, there was enough of a break in me this time, you know, after that Milwaukee's Best in that plastic cup. You know, it wasn't another bender where I was puking blood. It wasn't another bender where I ended up in the hospital. It was that plastic cup. So the consequences were much less than the last time. But, you know, something broke inside of me, and I became willing to try your solution, right, which is now our solution. You know, I'm part of the solution too. And something happened to me, and to me, having found the second step, I think when I stopped looking at Alcoholics Anonymous as like me and the people in AA, which is how I would think about it in my mind, right? The people in AA say this, the people in AA do that. That after a while, I was like, we do this and we do that. And that came just from coming here and participating and having a sponsor that made me do a bunch of things that I didn't want to do. You know, again, I found myself physically sober now, this time 4 months, 5 months, starting to get edgy again, starting to get really anxious again. And I had a guy who walked me through that and made me keep taking actions here, you know. And, you know, he made me learn the third step prayer. And my, if you know my sponsor, Arno, he's not a terribly religious guy, you know, but like me, he believes in a very practical God, you know, the God that lives in these rooms. And that's a God who, like in the seventh step prayer, says, I give all of myself to you, the good and the bad. You know, in my mind, God was someone that you presented a good picture to, and then you were supposed to hide and feel bad about the bad parts, right? And that's not how it is here. Like I give all myself to you, the flawed parts and the good parts, and help me do the best I can, you know. And having gone through that today, I think the sixth and seventh step are the most important parts of my recovery today, because I have the same defects of character I've had, I guess, all my life. I don't know, you know. And they still push my buttons today. And when I'm feeling uncomfortable, you know, it's something that's going on in there. I'm letting myself indulge in that type of thinking. And luckily, an amazing thing happened to me, too. After a while, I started calling my sponsor and giving him my inventory, right? And then he just one day stopped yelling at me. He just didn't yell at all anymore. I'm like, why does this guy not yell? And it took me years to realize, like, because you're doing the inventory. You know, you're not giving him bits and pieces of the stories that he would have to put the parts together and then figure out what's happening. I'm telling him everything. And that's the dialogue that we have today. And I think that sponsorship is crucial in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that relationship has changed as I have changed in AA, you know. And I think that you know, he guided me again. It was 11 months later. I was going back to Pennsylvania. He asked me the same question. How's that eight step coming? And I said, good. It's coming well. He's like, good. Well, then we're going to go over it on Monday. So I had to get busy writing again. You know, and I wrote that step down. And unfortunately, I was such a train wreck in my new sobriety. In my early sobriety, I lost my fourth step. Everyone's like, peep your fourth step, and I lost it like I was done. So I had to start over. And you know, actually, I found the eighth step easier to write than I found the fourth step to write. And again, my image again was that thing that, you know, you couldn't affect me. So it was hard for me to admit resentment when I was newly sober. But to see where I had harmed others was easier for me. And I wrote that step. And an amazing thing happened to me, too. I got more information of how I'm not so very important, you know, when I started to do my amends. Because there were some people I thought I must really have affected poorly. And I want to say I took that eighth step and went over it with my sponsor before I went about making my amends, you know. And some people I thought I really had harmed, and they probably were just devastated by the things I'd done in their life. And, you know, having made those amends, they were like, you know, I think I remember that. Really, that was you? You know, or something like that. And I'm like, wow, you know, it's a good thing I was carrying that around for my entire life. And you know, and then some people that I thought, well, that wasn't really a big deal, I really had affected. And it's lucky that I've made those amends, and there were a few people, not a few, more than a few, that I was to stay completely away from, you know. And I also had a very large amends. It was a large financial amends, about $11,000, you know, that I have not been able to make. Because it's a long story. It would affect a family member and affect some, destroy some relationships in my family. Recently, I've had an opportunity to make this amends with a person not knowing that I'm making amends to them because of the line of work that I do. And it's an amazing thing because I've been carrying this thing around forever, but I'm also greedy. I suffer from greed, right? And I was working out the numbers. I said, if I do this and that, they'll never know, and they'll get paid back, and they won't even know. And it's not a full amount, so I'm not going to admit that I stole from them, but at least the money will be back in their possession, you know? And 2 days later, I was like, I don't know. I mean, they don't know, you know? I mean, no, unbelievable, you know? And I had to immediately talk to my sponsor about that, because I know if I indulge in those kind of secrets, it'll stay that way. And before I know it, I'm like, I'm not doing it, keeping the money, you know? And, you know, and he also got me into prayer and meditation, you know. I had said the Lord's Prayer even when I was drinking, and I didn't know, I wasn't really connected to anything. I would just say it kind of like as an insurance policy. I'd be like, just in case, you know, say this prayer. You know, today, you know, prayer to me is more than just to getting on my knees twice a day, and I like to say the third and seventh step prayer, and sometimes the 11th step prayer and the 12 and 12, and it's a dialogue I have throughout the day, you know, because I can't, that middle of the day is the hardest point for me. That's when I get worked up. That's when, because that's when the stuff happens. Like in the morning, nothing terrible has happened yet, right? At the end of the day, I'm starting to unwind, things are okay, but the middle of the day, I get all wound up, and if I wait until the end of the day to do a written inventory, I don't know about anyone here, but I have a real short attention span. I'm like, I don't know, I think I was upset about something. I'm not sure. So I try to have a dialogue throughout the day with my higher power, who I call old man. So I'm like, really old man, the traffic is going to happen? And I do that. And for many years, I was getting good about meditation. You know, I was sitting quietly in the morning, and I haven't been good about that lately. And I'm the kind of person that really benefits from it, because I'm kind of a hyperactive spaz naturally. You know, but at the very least, what I do in the morning is I read from a couple of books as I drink my first cup of coffee and just try to take it easy and say a prayer before I go out into the day. And I maintain that, you know, that relationship with a sponsor today. And I am not ashamed to pick up the phone and call them three times in a day if I have to. It doesn't happen very often anymore, but there are times when I'm worked up and I got to talk to somebody. And I also have a network of other friends, and they're real friends in AA. They'll tell me the truth. They won't say like, yeah, she is a, you know what, screw her. They'll say, well, you're kind of being a jerk, you know, you got to look at that, you know, and that's important. Those are the real friends. I mean, that's true loyalty. True loyalty is someone who's willing to hurt my feelings and even maybe damage a friendship or lose a friendship to tell me the truth about myself, if it'll save me. And that's a great thing that I have in AA today. And yeah, the relationships with my family have been pretty much rebuilt. You know, I'm getting married. I'm 41 years old for the first time ever. I'm getting married July 3rd. You know, I also didn't think I was capable of marriage. I thought I had a lot of love to give, but it was a broad, you know, ray that I had, and now it's all focused on one person, you know, and she's happy about that, and I'm happy about that, and it's an amazing thing that my friends that know me know that I'm getting married. I think it's a miracle, and it really is, you know, it really is, and to make a decision to share, you know, my whole life with somebody and to go through all that is an amazing thing, and not that that's necessarily something that has to happen in sobriety, and you know, I try to, in my job, I sleep well at night. I still get anxious. You know, I work in a job that is only commission only for sales, right? And if I don't sell anything, I don't make a penny. And when I do, and I do, and luckily I've had some success in my job and things are going well, and I have to be careful because I can get greedy. And suddenly I can think that, well, I got to meet a client tonight. They really want to meet. And I told a new guy I'd meet him before the meeting, but I got to do this. Work comes first. Work comes first, right? And I got to be careful about that too. And I make sure that I practice the principles in all my affairs, and I do that today. You know, I'm an ethical businessman. I'm an honest businessman because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And you know, today, when I came here, I would hear people say, you know, AA gave me the life that I never thought I would have. In fact, if I had given you a list of the things that I, blah, 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 and I would have sold myself short. And I was like, I don't get that, because I want more money and more women and prestige and praise, but they were right, you know, because I don't have those things today. What I have instead is a sense of peace and ease that I carry around with me throughout the day. Most days, there are days when that goes away depending on my actions, but I feel pretty good most of the time. And it took many years of trudging this road for me to get there, but I believe that today that is the biggest gift of sobriety. It's not those things that are the byproducts of sober living. It's not if we have business success, if we find love, all of those things. It's a sense of ease and comfort I have thanks to this program. So that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.